Thank you for listening to the CPA Trendlines podcast, a production of CPATrendlines.com, now available on iTunes. CPA Trendlines presents an episode of The Disruptors.
Welcome to Accounting Disruptor Conversations. I'm your host, Liz Farr from CPA Trendlines. My guest today is Giles Pearson, co-founder of Accountess. How are you today, Giles?
Hi, Liz. It's good to be talking to you today from New Zealand.
Oh, wonderful. Well, it's kind of early spring here, so I suppose it must be kind of fallish in New Zealand.
Yeah, autumn or fall has started here. We've actually got some snow on the mountains today, so we've had a cold snap come through. But this is the best time of year to come to New Zealand. So for all the people who are thinking of coming down here, February and March is the time to come. So the best weather and see some of the fall colours. So yeah.
Oh, well, that's good to know. Well, anyways, we have a lot to cover, so let's jump in. Now, accounting talent in the U.S. and all around the world has been scarce for years. COVID made it worse. What are some ideas that you have on how to make things better?
Yeah, it's, you know, I spent a month traveling around visiting CPA firms and tax firms and bookkeeping firms in January. And, you know, this was a really hot topic of conversation. I'd have to say it is much more a conversation in the US than it is certainly down here in Australia and New Zealand. Mm. You know, one of the things that I guess I've been hearing a lot about is this 150-hour rule. And I think, you know, we can maybe talk about that a little bit further. But, you know, that seems to be a serious issue. And I get the fact that it's not the only reason that people don't enter the profession. But it's certainly from a time point of view and a cost point of view, you know, I'd see that as a significant barrier that the firm or that AICPA needs to work on and lobby to change, you know, fairly quickly. And I really don't see the need for that extra year. So that's something I think that can be done. You know, the other sort of lobbying issue I think that the profession probably needs to jump into is this whole tax season. Which, you know, when you say to people, for example, in New Zealand, we don't have a tax season, and they go, "What? You know, how can that possibly be?" And you know, I think the fact that there's these fairly short, hard deadlines that just make people work ridiculous hours for, you know, various periods of the year. Well, that's something the profession can easily lobby to change. And it's you know, it doesn't seem to me that it's insurmountable. The government just wants its money. Yes. And as long as you make sure that it gets its money or it gets interest on its money, then, you know, when you file a return is really irrelevant. That's just sort of confirming the last few dollars. So I think the profession can do something there which will hopefully make people look at accounting and go, you know, oh, I don't have to work 80-hour weeks for sort of 3 or 4 months of the year. You know, why at 23, 24 would I ever want to do that? Or, well, 23, 24 and onwards. So, you know, I think the profession can work on some of those things. I think firms as well can make life more interesting. You know, so I'm part of a running group here, and I was out yesterday running with this young guy who's in his last year at school, and he's taking accounting. And I said, are you thinking of doing accounting? And he goes, oh, nah, I don't want to be stuck in front of a computer all day. Hmm. You know, so that's the impression that people have of accounting. Whereas I think the whole sort of CAS part of accounting is much more interesting. And that's what he was saying to me. Mm-hmm. I want to be in business. I want to, you know, have that sort of entrepreneurial side. And I think that's where the sort of a whole advisory part of accounting you know, is much more interesting for everyone. And you know, sure, you've still got to learn the ropes and do those early years of you know, making sure you really understand the technical issues and you know, get that grounding. But if you can see a pathway to, you know, working closely with business owners on their strategy, you know, helping them out with you know, technology solutions for their accounting needs, that's, you know, that's interesting. You know, I think the other thing is probably around culture, and mm-hmm. you know, it's a challenge for firms now with this whole, you know, work from home and remote working, to make sure that they get that cultural fit right for their younger team members as well as their older ones. And I think what I saw in the US when I was visiting the firms there was they're actually getting pretty good at that, and a lot more switched on than, for example, in the UK where I was last year. And they're having terrible times trying to get people to come back into the office at all. You know, the young people there want to come into the office some of the time. The older ones don't want to come into the office at all. And that's causing some significant culture issues in firms there. And to some extent, that's where possibly the whole, you know, if your whole firm is remote, it almost makes it easier, because you then just have one set of cultures that you need to work to, where, you know, you work on making sure that sort of interpersonal stuff is happening. You're not trying to sort of retrofit that around a partial office, partial home working scenario. So, you know, I think those are some things that we can do as a profession, but firms can do individually to you know, make accounting more attractive and therefore get more people coming into the profession.
Yeah, I think those are all good ideas. Now, you mentioned that you're in New Zealand. How is qualifying for the equivalent of a CPA different in New Zealand than in the US?
Yeah. So you know, and I guess it's something that I've been reflecting on and having a look at. And so when you look at what you need to do here, and from my understanding, you know, in the US, you've got your 150 hours and then 1 year of experience in the CPA exam. Mm-hmm. And it's not, it's sort of the same, but here it's a 3-year degree. Mm-hmm. So you only need to do a 3-year bachelor's degree, and that's a standard, that's the standard bachelor's degree here. But you then have to do 3 years of mentored work experience. So you need to work for a CPA, and you need to have a logbook, and you need to choose various specialties, some of which you take to a certain level of proficiency, and then one at least you take to a much higher level of proficiency. And you need to work through that logbook with your mentor and make sure that your experience is up to the standard that you need. And you then, through that 3-year process, you then sit a graduate diploma in accounting, which is basically administered by the CPA societies here. And that's equivalent to a 1-year full-time study. And most firms would give people time off to do that. The most young accountants wouldn't take blocks of time off, unpaid time off to do that. They fit that around their work commitments. So it does mean those first 3 years out of college are quite full on, because people are studying and learning the trade at the same time. But at the end of that 3 years, and obviously they're being paid through that process. At the end of the 3 years, they then come out with their chartered accounting or CPA certificate. And I guess I reflect on that, and I reflect on my first 3 years of working. And if I only had to have done 1 year work experience, and I know what I was like at the end of 1 year. You know, and I'm sure this, you know, you can clearly just by looking at me, that was some time ago, but, you know, life hasn't changed in terms of how long it takes you to get your head into what accounting is all about. University courses haven't got any more work relevant, I don't think, in the 30 years since I did it, sadly. 1 year is not enough of work experience to then call yourself a CPA and go and, you know, put yourself in the market that you have that level of skills, because I actually just don't think that you do. You might have the you might be able to show that you've sat exams and you've got some theoretical knowledge, but it takes more than a year to apply that theory to practice to actually make you a half decent accountant, in my view.
It sounds like it's more of an apprenticeship program, and I think that really is the best way to learn, to have more on the job training, more practical training rather than more book training, you know. And well, here,
and I think that's the thing with the 150 hours, which is, you know, and all the discussion that I've heard is, you know, yes, quite a few people will do a master's in tax or whatever in that last year, but they don't actually need to do anything that's relevant. No. And if that's the case, well, surely a year's work experience would be a better use of their time. If you want to do a master's, absolutely, absolutely great. But but provide, you know, potentially in the shorter term, provide an option where you can swap out that fifth year for another year's work experience, you know, with some sign-off processes, and actually give that as an option to get you know, to get CPA instead. And I think that would it would provide a different pathway and be absolutely equally as good in terms of the product that you're going to get at the end of those, whatever that is, 6 years of training.
Right. I think I kind of agree with you. You know, I switched majors between the time I got my bachelor's and I decided to be an accountant. So the 150-hour rule was relatively meaningless for me. And the only thing that I really needed to do was get my 30 credit hours of accounting classes that the State Board of Accountancy required for me to sit for the CPA exam. So that was the only thing that it did for me.
Yeah.
But for somebody with an accounting undergraduate degree who isn't interested in pursuing something more difficult, a master's of tax or master's of finance or something like that, I'm not sure that that fifth year really has any practical utility. Yeah.
Well, look, and the reality is, yes, if you want to go and work for the Big Four, they might say you know we want to see that that fifth year, we want to see that master's, and absolutely fine, you know, go for it. But if you're going to enter into a small CPA firm in Ohio, you don't need a master's of tax. You actually need a lot of other skills that, you know, technical difficulty is not going to be the thing that's going to be your shortcoming in your ability to advise the clients that you're working with. There's a lot of other things that you're going to need to have, and you're not going to learn those sitting in a class at college.
No, absolutely not. Now, another thing that's a little different in the U.S. is how accounting firms operate. Now, you mentioned that you don't really have a busy season in New Zealand. How does that work?
I know. I think
I'm baffled.
Yeah. So you have a December 31 standard year end. We have a March 31 standard year end. And the only requirement that accounting firms need to have for tax filing is that they need to have all their tax returns filed by the March 31 of the next year. So they've got 12 months to file those returns. To be fair, probably less than 20% of people actually file returns because, there are no individual deductions. So for most wage and salary earners, there's no return to file. So the only returns that accounting firms are filing are for business owners and sort of people with more complex investment structures. But around that is a requirement to pay tax as you go, for relatively sort of smaller taxpayers, that's simply based on the year before's income. You can make payments through the year based on the previous year. And as long as you've got your return filed by March 31 in the following year, which is when you then top up whatever shortfall you haven't paid, that's all there is to do. So from a work management point of view, and I know people have said to me, oh, well, surely that just means everyone leaves things till the last minute and you just end up with a massive rush in March. There's a little bit of that, but the reality is, and this will be the same, this is the same everywhere, you know, 20% of business owners are desperate to have their financial returns and tax done in the first 60 days, because that's just how they are. And others need it in the first 3 or 4 months because they've got lenders who want to see the numbers. So you've got sort of self-selection works for quite a good portion of your client base, because they've got people who are demanding the information. Others who might be due large refunds have got an incentive to get their returns done quickly because then they'll get their money. And yes, there'll always be a few who leave it till the last minute. But the reality is for a lot of smaller firms here, by January, they are literally twiddling their thumbs. They've got their work done and they're then working on getting their clients ready for the next year end. I think, again, it comes down to the government. The government just wants their money. And as long as you have a mechanism for them to either get their money or get interest on their money because you haven't paid enough, and that really only applies to larger taxpayers, because they're the ones, obviously, from a fiscal point of view, makes the largest impact if they don't make the right payments. Then you take all of that filing deadline requirement away, so you can end up in a situation I would have thought quite easily where people have a requirement to pay by April 15, but no requirement to file. And if they don't pay the right amount, they pay interest. It's like, so again, you'll end up with self-selection. Some people will be motivated by that and others won't. And the firms here, the profession is getting increasingly sophisticated at managing client demand. So a lot of firms will just schedule their client work in, and they'll tell the clients, this is when you bring your work in. We don't want to see it after that. And if you bring it in after that, we don't know when we'll get around to it. This is when we've scheduled it. You need to be ready. This is the time. And that, of course, that doesn't work for everybody, but you can get 80% of your clients into a schedule that means that you can manage your own workflow rather than your clients managing your workflow for you.
Wow, fancy that. Now, and I think that in the US we could do that. And there are some firms that are doing that. It just takes a little bit of assertiveness.
Well, and the filing deadlines actually make quite a bit of that quite moot, because it's really how can you possibly schedule in all your work, before March 15 or April 15. It's just, I don't know how firms can cope with that. You know, obviously they work really hard to make sure they actually get all the information and are not or are automating the process of collecting information they don't have. And that's, you know, that's a smart way of trying to get around it. But to my mind, you know, AICPA and the profession should be lobbying federal government to look at the way that those deadlines are set and see what can be done. Because as I say, it should be fiscally neutral.
Yes.
And it would make a massive change to the
profession. Absolutely. Now, what about business models? You know, in the US, many firms still use hourly billing, and they're very hierarchical. You know, they've got a couple partners at the top, and then a layer of managers, and then a big fat layer of staff at the bottom. How is that compared to the model in New Zealand?
I think the firm structure's not necessarily that different. You know, technology is sort of flattening that pyramid out. You obviously need less people at that bottom end.
Right. But,
fixed price billing is very common. I'd say hourly rate billing for annual compliance and tax is less than 50% now. So fixed billing, and you know, I think the whole timesheet mentality. You know, there's been whole podcasts on the case for and against timesheets, and I sort of having spent my whole career. So I was 25 years with PwC in a smaller regional office, so probably like a mid-sized US firm. We had 45 people in our office, so it was you know, it was not a large environment. But you know, I did 25 years with timesheets, and so I get the benefits in terms of that, but I think what the firms need to focus on, and most of the firms that I met in my recent trip over were the more progressive firms, because they were the ones who put their hands up and said, "Yeah, we'd like to meet you." And you know, they're totally focused on productivity improvement, and I think that's rather than focusing on timesheets. I think focusing on productivity improvement is going to be the way that you're actually going to make more money, and you're going to get jobs out the door quicker. You know, the challenge in that is getting the pricing right. But to some extent, the market gives you that pricing. And there's no reason, for example, not to do some work on a sort of a case-by-case basis to understand how long jobs are taking, and you know, there's always the ones you get that you misprice. You know, and though, you know, that's a question of just understanding how badly you've mispriced it and having that upfront discussion with the client. But yeah, I think focusing on productivity improvement rather than timesheet recording is going to get you a much better answer over time.
Yeah. Now, what about growth in firms? Do you think that firms really even need to grow? I mean, many of them focus on growth as this big sexy thing that they've got to do, but does every firm really need to do that?
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's sort of interesting. I spent my time working, so I was a sort of a tax partner, I guess, but had a lot of private clients. So a lot of our clients were sort of large owner-operated businesses. And What you saw was over the years, you know, you talk to people, some people listened to what you said and acted on it. Other people listened and talked to a range of other people and acted. Others listened to a range of people and did nothing. So you quickly realize that there are different sorts of people in business, and some people are particularly entrepreneurial and motivated. Others are just not. And accountants are no different to that. So I guess as a slight segue to perhaps try and answer your question is, I think some accountants are not born business people. And in terms of, you know, that whole ability to grow, they probably actually just don't have the ability to grow because it's not in their mindset. What they want to do is they just want to serve clients. They want to work hard or not too hard and take home a reasonable income. But what pushes their buttons is providing tax advice, providing business advice, you know, having those, that working with the clients and the whole being in business part of accounting is just something that they just don't get and are not really that interested in, which is sort of bizarre for people who are there helping business owners. But I think that's the reality. So I don't think there is a need to grow, but clearly there are accountants who are very entrepreneurial. And again, you know, you come back to that discussion around productivity and improving productivity. What they're doing is pushing the boundaries, both in terms of tech, but in terms of where's the profession going. And that's, you know, moving away from compliance tax and compliance accounting towards business advice, you know, virtual controller, virtual CFO, CAS, all of this, you know, that's the direction of travel. And you know, you can certainly grow and mature your firm and make it a more interesting place to work as well, to be fair, by doing that. Or you just absolutely systematize everything. You know, and for example, one of the accounting firm owners I met who wasn't even an accountant has got a team of 65, all remote, and he just spends his day working on systems and processes and, you know, making sure that he's got quality standards and he's got turnaround and he's got productivity and, you know, half of the team are in South America and, you know, so this is the, I think if you want to grow, that is that you can just get really, really efficient at compliance, I guess, is what they're doing. And I saw a fair bit of that. But I'm not sure I've really answered your question, but I don't think growth for growth's sake is necessarily going to be the saviour of firms. And I think some people are just not suited to it.
I would agree with you there. You know, I worked with a couple of firm owners who had not a single entrepreneurial bone in their bodies. And they really just wanted to serve the clients and do their work and get paid and lead a small team. And that was good.
Yeah. That's right. You know, and that's sort of, to be fair, that probably fits the archetypal accountant personality.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Which is still a thing.
Yeah. Now your firm, Accountus, specializes in skills testing for new hires. Now, one dilemma that I think accountants here in the U.S. have is that it's not just that it's hard to find people with the skills that they need, but it's hard to find warm bodies, period. Yep. So how do you balance that, the need for skills and just the scarcity of talent?
Yeah, well, they're almost two different questions. I think the scarcity of talent comes back to that question we started with, yeah. which is, you know, how do we improve the perception of accounting as a mm-hmm. profession? And, you know, I know there's quite a bit of work being done, bringing in high school graduates into firms, you know, bringing people from, you know, who clearly know virtually nothing about accounting and mm-hmm. and training them on the job. And look, I think that's, as an interim step anyway, that's a sensible solution. I think that the better solution is for people to want to come into accounting and to go through the more traditional pathway, so that the firms actually get people who, you know, it's a lot more expensive to bring somebody through from high school, particularly if you're paying for their training, mm-hmm. than it is to bring somebody who's coming out of college. But I guess in terms of the sort of skills testing, you know, the challenge firms have, as you say, is just not getting enough candidates for their roles, you know, the testing part of that it makes the testing part a bit more challenging, and I think that is changing, and certainly we're seeing some of that through our statistics. I think is that you know, the market is improving. It's not an employer friendly market as yet, but it's not as extreme as it was, say, towards the middle and end of last year. But look, you know, my experience and why we ended up with developing this business. So, you know, at the firm that I was at, you know, we hired people who didn't have the technical skills that we were expecting. Mm-hmm. And we saw quite a few of our clients hiring people who didn't turn out well for them. And that was the genesis of the idea. We went looking for some skills tests to use, and just couldn't find anything that was of a good enough technical competency and professionalism that we would have felt happy putting in front of a candidate who was going to come to work for us. Most of them were either simple or just old, you know, pre-cloud accounting sort of focus and T accounts and all this stuff. And you just look at that and you go, what are they even talking about? I have no idea. Mm-hmm. So that was the genesis of our idea to build a test suite that public accounting firms could use to test their candidates. And, you know, the reality is whether you've got one candidate or three or 20, you're still much better to understand what their technical capability is before they start with you than waiting for three mm-hmm. months down the line. And then sort of the grinding teeth moment comes along and it's like, this is not working out. You know, now what do I do? Do I exit this person? Do I suck it up and train them? You know, so forewarned is forearmed. If you've got a job at a particular level and you test somebody and they're not at that level, but you need to hire somebody anyway, well, you can have an open discussion with that person about what sort of training it might be that they need. Who are you going to have them work with? So if somebody needs a bit more help and guidance, there's possibly one of your managers who's going to be more sympathetic. Or there might be a manager that you really, really don't want to put them with, but you know that all that's going to do is going to, you know, people who've got a short fuse when it comes to people who don't understand. And look, to be honest, have a discussion around salary as well, because it's like you've applied for this job, you know, with this remuneration package. But the requirements were that, you know, we're looking for somebody with this level of skills, and what you're showing me is you don't have that. I'm willing to hire you, and I want to work with you to make you get you to that level. So I'm going to make some investment in you. Let's talk about salary, starting salary, and maybe a review at 3 months, 6 months, whilst we work towards getting you to the skill level that you need to be to justify the salary that that we're offering somebody who does have those skills. So it's around trying to make it a positive experience. And I think that cuts both ways. You know, candidates, candidates who want to, who are applying for a job where they actually want to stay with that firm, as opposed to, I want a job to put on my CV, I'm going to be there 18 months, you know, and then I'm going to move on. You know, they're actually not going to care, those candidates. They're ticking a box. But for a candidate who actually wants to build a longer term relationship with a firm, having that sort of, having a firm who's interested enough in them to put them through, you know, skills, but also other testing as well, maybe personality profile, and wanting to spend that time getting to understand what's going to work for them, and explaining to them why they're doing that, and that the test is not a pass fail. You know, it just makes the whole experience, you know, more rewarding, I think, for both parties.
I agree with you. You know, I wish that they'd had something like that, the firms where I worked. It would have possibly screened out a few people. You know, there was one young man I worked with who couldn't reconcile himself, his way out of an alley. You know, he just never could do that. And there was another job where we were acting as the remote CFO for a company that had lost their CFO because, frankly, this person they hired did not have the skills. And we came in and there was a big stack of tax filings, payroll tax warnings, because it seemed that his approach to paying payroll taxes was to pay something and then find out later that he'd paid the wrong amount and then pay the right amount plus interest and penalties. And so there's a nice stack, about an inch thick of problems with payroll taxes.
Yeah, that's right. Look, and you know, at the end of the day, when you're hiring somebody, there's only so much you can do. I guess what we've tried to do is make it as short and as simple as we can by having, you know, a half hour intensive technical test where you get to see a candidate's response to 40 questions, 40 technical questions that are at the right level for them. And yes, it's challenging for them as a candidate to be asked to do that. But at the same time, it's a lot easier for the employer than trying to elicit that amount of information in another way. And some firms have tests that they have built in-house or things that they do. Corporates, you know, I know may use something like a little case study where they get people to go away and you know, and these sort of things are actually really good. And some of them are excellent. They tend to work for people at a particular level. So they're not, you can't flex them for a junior person versus a, you know, a senior accounting manager. You know, you can't, so you then need, it's like, well, so do you have multiple tests for that? And, you know, that's challenging. Or you can ask questions at interview, but how many questions can you realistically ask?
Right.
And what's the science behind that? Whereas what we did was get a norm group of, if it's a CPA level test, get a norm group of sort of CPAs in that area to sit the tests, so that when your candidate sits it, instead of just a raw score, you've actually got something to compare your right. candidate with a pool of what is essentially the population of say public accounting CPAs. So that makes it good for small firms who don't have that benchmark. If you do a lot of tests of anything, of course you can develop your own internal benchmarks, because you can see, here's this person, they scored, you know, whatever, 60% in the test, and this is how they've turned out. So I get a little data point on that. And when you've had 10 people go through the test and you've got all of those data points, suddenly you're getting your own benchmark. But our tests, I guess, are particularly good for the small firms who just don't have that sort of benchmarking. So we provide the benchmarking for them as part of the test.
That's very useful. Now, in your travels around the accounting world, there must be some things you see accountants keep on doing that are really contrary to their well-being, to their best interests. So what are some things that you think accountants should stop doing immediately?
It sort of comes back to the same thing, I think, but it's the old working on your business and not in your business. Mm-hmm. And accountants are really good at working in their businesses. Yes. So, you know, I think, for example, if you don't have a mentor as an accounting firm owner, you should have one. There are quite a few who are providing that in an online way. So, you effectively join a community of other firm owners. And a lot of that is about guidance for developing the firm that you want, you know, and I think that's where the better of the mentors flex or their products flex towards the different people and what it is that they're trying to achieve in their firms. But there's totally ways to make your firm work more efficiently, get it structured right. You know, the first thing that I guess the mentors will often do is say, you know, what does the structure look like? How do you deal with information? How do you deal with client queries? How do we move that around so that you, the business owner, are not the bottleneck? You know, and you work out how respectfully to delegate a lot of that client interaction to people further down the chain. So I guess in answer to your question, I would say don't stick your head in the sand. You know, use the resources that are out there and the collegiality that you get from those groups. Yes. And having, you know, we're involved in a couple of those, not because we're an accounting firm, but because we're helping their members, you know, with their hiring processes, and seeing the quality of the discussions that happen on the typically Facebook groups that they set up, the quality of the discussions between the firm owners is just gold. You know, that can provide more value than mentor actually provides themselves at times.
I think you're onto something. I think there is tremendous power in community and informal networks, mentorships, and just asking questions of people who have maybe tried something or who maybe know somebody who's tried something different.
And look, in the old days, we would have done that through the CPA societies.
Yes.
And I know I was reading an article from the Nevada CPA yesterday, and they were talking about how many people turn up to their member events, and very, very few. And, you know, it's so their one of their big challenges is to how to get more member collaboration. But I think that's where the mentoring route is a replacement for what would have been that local collegiality in amongst members in a geographical area. You know, sadly, those days are probably past.
I agree with you there, and particularly in very large states with small scattered populations. You know, it's much easier to find somebody online than in person.
And look, the reality is you're probably more likely to find people who are like-minded like you in an online community if you find the right ones than in your local community, where, you know, to be fair, 80% of even the local CPAs are probably not doing what you're trying to do.
No, they're not doing that. Now, what do you think keeps accountants from making these changes that they know they need to make? But what are the blocks to making those changes?
I think tax season has probably got to be right up there. You know, how I know we're going sort of round in circles, but how can you possibly run a sensible business when a third of your year you can't even lift your head above water and think about what's going on? You know, it's really hard to run a strategy in a business that goes from boom to bust like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that's that definitely makes it harder.
I would agree with you there. Very hard to make changes when there's no time to do anything.
Well, and it's the lack of continuity, I guess, because you know you can pick something up and try and work on it, and then, you know, very quickly you're having to put it down again and look at it for, you know, 2 months or whatever.
Exactly. Now I want you to kind of get out your crystal ball and think about what will be the trends for accounting in the future. Client accounting services, CAS, client advisory services, whatever we want to call it, that's a really big thing right now. What do you think will be the next big thing?
I think CAS has got a long way to go. Actually, I think, and just talking, you know, you look at some of the stats and you look at the proportion of fees that firms are earning from compliance versus advisory. Advisory is still down at 15% maybe of income for firms. So I think CAS has got a long, long way to go. You know, compliance is, you know, there's all this talk about AI doing, you know, doing tax returns and things. I think we're a little way away from that yet. It's going to be yet another challenge, though, to the compliance part of accounting firms' business, and obviously cloud was part of that. So that moved a step away from that heavy duty lifting. AI, I think, will be another step in that journey. CAS is where the real value can be added. You know, and that's all around interactions with business owners. It's about talking to people, and that's the stuff that AI can't do. You know, is that the nuances of human behavior. We're a long way from that. Maybe that's probably a good thing. So I think CAS, you know, it's been interesting listening to all the talk about equity or private equity coming into firms and what they do, you know, and I guess when you look at what private equity are looking at is expanding the breadth of services that firms are offering into things like, you know, insurance and wealth management. Accountants have great skills for offering wealth management services. I think that's probably in terms of, you know, what's possible. Wealth management, I think, is open for people who have a high level of trust with their clients. There is an issue, I think, with overreach with some of that, and we saw that here with firms that came in and added mortgage broking and insurance and these sorts of things. And I struggle with that from a conflict of interest perspective. I think you end up getting to the point where the moment clients are thinking, why are they suggesting this? Is it to do with the amount of commissions they're going to earn? You know, these people are doing are pushing me at stuff because they're going to earn money from it. The moment you get to that point, you've stepped over a line, I think, as a profession. So I do worry about some of that, but I think something like wealth management, where fees are transparent and accountants have really good opportunities to and relationships with their clients, I think that's, you know, that's open. But I would go for CAS first. It's core business, and there's so much value that you can add to the business owner. I think accountants, you know, probably need to get more entrepreneurial to some extent. But the key with CAS, I guess, is about actually allowing the business owner to make entrepreneurial decisions whilst you're providing them with perspective, analysis, and, you know, some technical rigor to be able to challenge what they're thinking. Let them make the entrepreneurial decisions. That's why they're in business, and it's their risk in the end, you know.
I think that's the perfect role for these non-entrepreneurial accountants to have, to be able to analyze the business from a strictly analytical point of view, but yet also try to put on that entrepreneurial hat a little bit and look at the business, at their clients' businesses, as a business owner would.
Yeah, and you know, look, I think the learning absolutely goes both ways there. You know, yes. Accountants learn from their clients, and you know, the big thing that we add, there's the technical rigor and the understanding of, you know, making sure that the clients have got good information to work with. But we also add that perspective because we're in a really lucky situation where we get to see the consequences of a lot of different business decisions in an environment where even leaning over the back fence and talking to your neighbour, you're not likely to get that honesty in terms of here's what they did and here's how it turned out. We get to see that and we get to be able to reflect that back to our other clients that we're working with, and that's such a huge value that we can provide, and no one else is going to be able to do that whilst we maintain our professional standards, you know, around confidentiality. I was just going to say, you know, one of the things that really struck me in the US, which I was so impressed with, is people really working on their niche. And that's the other part of, or another part of this, is the ability for you to have information around a particular segment of business. And I think remote accounting practices have really grasped this, in that they can go deep and narrow, not only become total subject matter experts on their niche, but be able to then provide that benchmarking across their client base. And I think, you know, the move to remote firms has made that so easy. So in terms of another trend which is coming, I think deep and narrow is something that firms should be working much more towards, because if you don't do that, you're going to find there's a remote firm somewhere who's going to be going after your clients, and they're going to be pretty interested in somebody who's got a huge understanding of their particular industry that you just can never have.
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely correct. And I think that's the, you know, leveraging your expertise as an expert in a specific area plus your analytical abilities, I think that combining those things will really ensure the survival, and not just survival, but the thriving of our profession for years to come.
Yeah, I think that's right. Just need to get the people in, hey?
Yes, we just need the warm bodies. Well, I think that's a perfect way to end our conversation. We kind of came back to where we started off with, the struggle for warm bodies in the profession. I want to thank you, Giles, for taking the time to talk to me. Now, if listeners want to connect with you, what's the best way to find you?
On LinkedIn. So just Giles Pearson on LinkedIn. Send me a message. Click through to our website if you want to do that. My email is just giles@accounttests.com, but you'll find all that on LinkedIn. So yeah, hit me up there.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, and you have a wonderful day.
Thanks, Liz. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Really good.
Great.
Thank you for listening to the CPA Trendlines podcast, a production of cpatrendlines.com, now available on iTunes. We hope you'll rate and review us wherever you find your podcasts to help other accountants find our show more easily. For more information, you can go to cpatrendlines.com.